This week on Daiwa, we're in Hancock County. A farmer is murdered by three machine gun killers.
Welcome to Daiwa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaValle and Allie Tulin.
All right, Beth, Hancock County. We've got a northern centerish county. Bigger towns in it would be like Forest City, Garner, and Britt. And yes, it's named after John Hancock, who's remembered for his stylish signature on the Declaration of Independence. Have you been?
I don't think I've been. If I have, maybe Forest City, but I don't remember it if I have been.
Yeah, I am also a no on this one.
Bummer.
I know, but did look up some things and I found out it's home to Pilot Knob State Park, which is located southeast of Forest City, Iowa. The park was dedicated in 1924 and has camping, fishing, hiking, and bird watching. And there's an observation tower that's 30 feet tall, but it was originally supposed to be 40. And it was said that like winter set in and they just decided to stop it at the 30 feet instead. But also within the park, there's a place called Dead Man's Lake, which is kind of on theme, and also a 4-acre floating. I have no idea how to say this. I'm going to look this up.
I have no idea. What an interesting word. What does that mean?
How to pronounce sphagnum. It means peat moss. Or it's actually the only one in Iowa.
So I found another place of interest in Hancock County. In Britt, Iowa, you can visit the National Hobo Museum.
Oh.
So some backstory on that. Since the year 1900, Britt has been hosting a National Hobo Convention, which is a weekend festival that includes a parade, some other entertainment, food, etc. Sounds like any town fair or picnic, but the highlight during the convention is the election of the king and queen of the hobos. Oh my god, I'm submitting you next year. And just in case you didn't know, a hobo was a migratory worker who helped satisfy America's labor needs after the Civil War. They were, quote, homeless by choice, they worked to travel and traveled to work, and their mode of transportation was always freight trains. So in the 1970s, three lifelong hobos and former hobo kings of Britt came together to preserve the history of the American hobo and formed the Hobo Foundation. The hobo kings wanted to make sure hobo stories would be passed down to future generations. Now the foundation is made up of hobos and residents of Britt, and they created the National Hobo Museum, which started in the early 1980s, quote, with a single box of artifacts and a gift of money from an unknown hobo, according to their website. The museum is now permanent and has artifacts from all over the world donated by former hobo kings and queens, collectors, and the families of hobos. It also tells the century-long story of the National Hobo Convention and showcases personal collections of many of the more notable American hobos, including Steam Train Maury, the Pennsylvania Kid, Connecticut Slim, the Hard Rock Kid, Frisco Jack, and others.
I would love to hear so much more about those hobos.
Oh my god, me too. That's like the most I've ever said the word hobo in my life, I think.
Okay, well, we're adding it on our list, the yes. Britt Hobo Festival.
Oh my god.
But let's get to the story. It's Saturday, November 2nd of 1935. FDR is president. Huey Long, the senator from Louisiana, was assassinated that year. The Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movie Top Hat is released, and Elvis Presley and his twin brother are born in Mississippi.
And near Duncan, Iowa, which is kind of by Mason City, James Roslick, his wife Rose, and their baby are driving to attend Mass at St. Wenceslaus Church in their 1934 Chevrolet coach with red wheels. When they approached an intersection, they saw a wrecked car and three men standing on the side of the road. James slowed down, and one of the men raised a revolver and fired. James was hit and slumped in his seat. Rose and the baby also had blood on their faces from flying glass. The leader of the three men yelled at him to get out, but Jim couldn't move, so the men drug James from the car and left him there to die with his wife and baby. After the men drove off, Rose, who was wounded from either bullets fired or shattered glass, ran with her baby to the farm home of Harry Schmidt nearby. An eerie coincidence about where James died. It was actually the same intersection his brother Edward was killed in a car accident a year before.
Meanwhile, the three men made their way to the Gremmers family farm about 10 miles northwest of Britt. Eppo Gremmer said his family was held hostage for about 2 hours while the men attempted to treat their cuts that they had received in their car wreck before taking the Zarostlik car. They then took Gremmer's car and drove north.
News of the Zarostlik murder spread. A state agent named Paul Gruber left Council Bluffs, Iowa in a plane for Britt to investigate the case. Sheriffs from Garner and Clarion reported the shooting to the State Bureau of Investigation and heard that the three men had also held up and stolen a vehicle from a Des Moines group near Belmont. The three men had wiped fingerprints and taken the license plate of their vehicle, which had run out of gas, and then took the group's vehicle, which they drove until they ran it into a ditch near Britt. This was the car crash the Zarostliks had come across. They left their shotguns and a machine gun in the wrecked vehicle before taking off in the Zarostliks' car.
When the State Bureau investigated the Des Moines party's vehicle, they found ammunition and traces of blood, which they believed indicated one of the men had been injured. The Bureau took special precautions to preserve fingerprints found in the vehicle, and they also received descriptions of the three men from Rose Zarostlik. She said, number one was about 30 years old, 5'8", full-faced, dressed in dark clothing and a cap. Number two was also about 30, 5'9", slender, dressed in dark clothes and a light top coat. And number three had no personal description. He was dressed in dark clothing and wearing a cap.
That Sunday, just a day after James's murder, newspapers put out the word to be on the watch for the three bandits, especially at hospitals and for physicians. Sheriff Carl Dahlhauser of Kossuth County said officers were still patrolling county roads, and Sheriff E.P. Hansen of Garner said officers under his direction were still guarding highways.
2 days after the murder, the Bureau caught two men who had robbed a seed store and kidnapped two Iowa men. However, Glenn Schmidt, chief of the State Bureau of Investigation, said the two men caught in the other robbery and kidnapping had been eliminated as suspects in the James Zarostlik slaying.
On Monday, November 4th, James Zarostlik's funeral was held in Duncan, Iowa, at the St. Wenceslaus Church. It was the same church he had been married 3 years earlier and where he was going the Saturday morning he was killed. It was reported in the Des Moines Tribune that a crowd of over 1,000 Hancock County citizens gathered for the service. Rose, James's wife, was still suffering from an eye injury from the attack and wore a heavy veil. Her 2-year-old son, Clarence, was with her.
13 days after the murder, on Friday, November 15th, Iowa Special Agent Paul Gruber reported that the car in which the three men escaped, the car that they had stolen from Eppo Gremmer, had been discovered in Valley Springs, South Dakota, but they still didn't have the men. Sheriff E.P. Hansen had gone to Valley Springs, South Dakota to retrieve and return the Gremmer's vehicle.
On November 16th, in Hibbing, Minnesota, a posse of 10 officers captured Earl Blood. Blood was 34 years old and wanted in Iowa for bank robbery and murder. The posse found him in a small cabin 40 miles north of Hibbing. Police said he was also wanted in connection with the slaying of James Zarostlik. Chief Chester Naseth of Hibbing received a tip that Blood was hiding in the area. Half a dozen local patrolmen and deputies from the St. Louis County went into the woods during the night and came up on Blood when he was sleeping around 2 a.m. In his cabin, they found a .38 caliber pistol, some old clothing, and $50 in federal notes.
Blood was held in the county jail until officers could find his companions. Chief Nasa said Blood offered no resistance when he was awakened and denied any connection with the Iowa crimes. However, the chief had heard from people in Meadowbrook that Blood was going around the town telling people he had been in Iowa 10 days ago to see a brother and look for work. Agent Paul Gruber said information had been sent to Hibbing authorities a week ago. After investigating the murder and talking to Rose Zarostlik and the Gremmer family, descriptions given matched Blood. Blood had been at several North Iowa farms asking for jobs husking corn prior to James's murder, and he had told some of these farmers he had formerly lived in Hibbing, Minnesota. As far as Agent Gruber knew, Blood had no jail record.
To make sure Blood was one of the three men, authorities were planning to have survivors of the run-ins with the men, like Eppo Gremmer family members, identify Earl Blood. On November 20th, two members of the Gremmer family were on their way to Duluth, Minnesota to identify him. However, they were unable to identify a picture of Earl Blood as one of the bandits. Chief Schmidt reported he was convinced Earl Blood had no connection with the slaying of James Zroslik.
There is then no word until Wednesday, December 4th, over a month since James's murder. Agent Paul Gruber said he is convinced that two men who held up and robbed a banking office in Lakota, Iowa, also participated in James's murder. Gruber said, quote, "The descriptions tally throughout, and the Lakota Bank was the same type that this gang has been robbing. Moreover, the methods used are the same throughout." But then nothing comes of this.
Then we get hope again, 2 months after the murder. On Friday, January 3rd, a Missouri State Highway Patrol captain wired the Iowa State Bureau of Investigation saying he believed Homer Fanning and a companion murdered James. Pictures of Fanning were sent to the Gremmer farm for identification. Fanning was a 26-year-old former convict who fit the description and was captured in Missouri. The companion traveling with Fanning was Alvin Karpis, who escaped and was listed as public enemy number one. Fanning's own description of guns in his possession fit the description of the gun used to slay James. Fanning was taken to Macon, Missouri for questioning in connection with recent robberies. The Missouri patrol captain said he had communicated with the Iowa State Bureau of Investigation but had not received a reply from any Iowa officials. However, Fanning is cleared.
So then on January 6th, the Des Moines Register had a piece on James's wife, Rose. It was titled, "Can't Forget Face of Bandit Who Killed Her Husband." Rose told the paper that she lives in constant fear. She had lost 20 pounds and sometimes dreamt of the crime being reenacted. She also said for weeks after, her baby screamed whenever he was put in a car. She had to stay in Mason City for a few weeks after the murder to have the glass from the car's windshield plucked from her face, and she's still unable to see out of her right eye. Her description of the man who shot James was, quote, "He was rather tall, dark, and had a scar on the side of his face," which was new from the earlier descriptions that were received.
Nothing is heard again until 1937. Another bank robber is captured. This time, it's Thomas Runyon. He was arrested in Wichita, Kansas, in connection with several bank robberies in Iowa and other Midwestern states. Runyon is described as having a small build, blue eyes, blonde hair, and a noticeable scar on the right side of his nose. Agent Gruber announced that Runyon had signed a statement admitting to several robberies while disguised as a Catholic priest. Agent Gruber said, quote, "There's no question that Runyon is one of the Zroslik slayers. Although he denies it, his description tallies in several particulars with the smallest of the three." The other two men in the gang were identified as Claire Gibson and Robert Markwood. Witnesses were being driven to Sioux City to confirm Runyon's involvement. Three members of the Gremmer family and some from the Des Moines hunting party went to view Runyon, but the results of the viewing were kept secret by the authorities.
2 years after the murder, on March 4th, Agent Gruber said several people were able to identify Runyon as one of the three bandits who shot James over 16 months ago. The accomplices, Claire Gibson and Robert Markwood, were reported to be still at large.
Runyon was quoted saying on March 5th that, quote, "I did not kill James Zroslik and did not shoot at a soul in my life. Sure, I robbed a couple banks in Minnesota with Claire Gibson, but we never did believe in any rough stuff. There's no sense to shooting, for it can't do you any good." However, this time authorities had the right guy. They also confirmed Runyon's accomplices were dead. Claire Gibson was arrested in Oregon in 1937 and committed suicide in a Minneapolis jail, and Robert Markwood's body was found beside a highway in South Dakota.
On Friday, March 5th, Judge F.H. Rice issued a writ of habeas corpus ordering immediate presentation in district court of Thomas Runyon, whom authorities were holding for a Britt murder and two bank holdups. The writ was against the sheriffs of Woodbury, Hancock, and Cerro Gordo counties and Paul Gruber. Gruber had taken Runyon to the Cerro Gordo County Jail. Defense attorneys asserted issuance of the writ was within their court's jurisdiction as the constant moving of Runyon made it impossible for them to determine his whereabouts. However, Runyon was being held in Cerro Gordo as Hancock authorities went ahead with the plans for the prosecution of Runyon on a first-degree murder charge. The attorney general appealed to the Supreme Court to forestall a move he said he feared would bring a gangland attempt to free Runyon. He asked the court to nullify the writ of habeas corpus, which would require the state to take Runyon to Sioux City for the hearing. The court set a hearing on his request for 5 p.m.
On Monday, March 8th, Runyon confessed he was one of the gang members that killed James Roslick and was sentenced to life imprisonment. The Gazette said Runyon's sudden plea and quick sentence came after he was secretly moved here from the Cerro Gordo County Jail in Mason City and arraigned before Judge Henry Gravin on only a second-degree murder charge instead of first. Judge Gravin said that Runyon was dealt with leniently, in turn for which he confessed the bank robber promised to tell all he knows of the gang of mobsters and killers operating in the territory.
It was said Rose Roslick was called to the witness stand to testify in the trial and broke down in tears before finishing her testimony.
Years pass, and Runyon was serving his life term in Fort Madison, but he makes news again when on Monday, September 13th of 1943, he escaped from the Iowa penitentiary. According to the State Board of Parole, Runyon dug under the electrically charged fence surrounding the grounds. The escape was discovered at 8 p.m. when guards made the customary round of prisoners. He is believed to have escaped around 7:30 p.m. A member of the board said Runyon was the only missing prisoner and they were unsure if he was armed. Runyon was the editor of the Presidio, a monthly magazine published by inmates.
While on the run, Runyon abducted two parties. First, he appeared Thursday evening at the farm home of Earl Vincent near West Point, which is 12 miles from Fort Madison. Runyon surprised Vincent in the hayloft of his barn, forcing him to hand over a shotgun and take him into the home. Then inside the home, he made Mrs. Vincent make him supper and then forced the Vincents and their daughter into a car and told them to head north. They stopped at an oil station to get 6 gallons of gas and then to Van's lunchroom to buy cigarettes. The Vincent's car then developed tire trouble, and Runyon told them to stop at Ross McCready's house. McCready was an auto mechanic living in Haskins, which is almost 50 miles from West Point.
The Vincents told McCready they needed help getting to Iowa City, and McCready agreed to help them. So they all got into his car, and a few minutes into the drive, Runyon told McCready who he was, and he forced the Vincents out of the car. He then told McCready to drive him toward Iowa City. 10 miles north of Haskins, Runyon ordered McCready to start taking side roads. They then reached a point near Riverside where Runyon forced McCready from the car and drove away. Both Vincent and McCready reported that Runyon made no attempt to hide his identity. Vincent said that as long as he did what he was told, Runyon promised no one would be hurt.
5 days after his escape, Runyon was back at the penitentiary. He had been captured after a gun battle with police around 10 p.m. in Fort Dodge. The penitentiary warden said Runyon would receive solid lockup, which meant he would have no contact with the outside world. When asked how long that meant, the warden replied, quote, until I decide to let him out.
While serving time, Thomas Runyon became a famous writer. He wrote a widely circulated book titled In for Life. He also had published many articles about prison life and was the editor of the prison magazine. Mystery writer Earl Stanley Gardner had attempted to win Runyon a parole, but it never panned out. He died of a heart attack in the prison hospital on Thursday, April 11th, 1957. He is buried in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, near his mother.
At the time of his death, James Roslick was 26 or 27 years old. He's buried at the St. John Cemetery in Duncan, Iowa, with his parents and other family members. Rose went on to remarry in 1941 and had a large family. She passed away in 2004 at the age of 91 and is buried with her second husband in Osage, Iowa. Should we give Taps a call?
Sounds good.
Hey, Taps. Thanks for joining.
Good evening.
We are doing Hancock County this week. Have you been?
I have been to Hancock County.
Are you familiar with the hobo invention in Brit?
I am familiar with that. Although the term hobo has not been used in the popular lexicon for many years.
It sounds like it's still a thing in Hancock County.
The most notorious thing about Hancock County is it is right next to where Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Richie Valens died in the plane crash. I think it's about maybe 5 or 6 miles east of Hancock County, north of Clear Lake. And the anniversary of that will be this Friday, February 3rd. It will be 64 years since the music died.
I think this episode will come out a little later, but
Wait, do you know that date by heart?
Of course. If you're a connoisseur of the rock and roll, you know the day the music died.
Okay, what happens when someone is falsely accused of a crime like blood was in this case? Like, for example, can you sue for slander?
You cannot sue for slander. You could probably sue for malicious prosecution if you could prove that somebody went after them for malicious reasons. Lately, there has been a movement in the United States to compensate people that have been wrongly accused and then freed. The closest to Iowa would be a case in Beatrice, Nebraska, where I believe it was 6 or 7 people were accused of murder of a elderly woman.
Oh, it's the Beatrice, isn't it 5? The Beatrice?
Maybe it's 5. It could be 5.
There's a newer HBO documentary on that.
Right. They got a judgment settlement against the county and the city, and the county actually had to raise a special tax levy to pay off these people. And the tragic part was one guy died in an industrial accident about a year after he was out of prison and never got any of the money.
Oh, okay. I'm correcting myself. It is the Beatrice 6.
Okay.
In this case, so they had the machine gun bandits were on the run, but they had gone and kidnapped or held hostage a local family for a while. Later on, authorities were using that family to identify suspects. And so they would send up members of the Grummer family to make sure it was the killer. How do you do that today? Do you still use witnesses and then ship them to a place?
Well, not necessarily. So the Supreme Court has ruled that individual suspect identifications are extremely prejudicial. Those kind of identifications are called show-ups. And what the case law tells cops, if you grab somebody within about 2 hours of a crime, you are allowed to bring the suspect to the victim and show them that person to see if they can identify him. If it's more than 2 hours, then the court is going to require you to have a lineup, a formal lineup, which has a lot of really Fifth and Sixth Amendment connotations and has to be done very formally. There's very stringent rules, whatever. So because of the problems with witness identifications, the courts have really gotten involved in these cases. Now, this case is old enough that those cases wouldn't have applied.
Are lineups still pretty common today?
Yeah, they still happen frequently. Most larger agencies have a lineup room where they have a one-way glass and people can line up, whatever. But the court gives you very, very strict rules on how you have to conduct it. The suspect's attorney can be present and is allowed to be present during the lineup. People have to be of the same, obviously, gender, race, somewhat similar physical attributes, have to be dressed the same. There's just a lot of different rules. So they're not done as frequently just because they're so hard to put on.
Like, what is your opinion on lineups? Do you think they work? Do you have a better solution?
No, I think they're a tool. I think that if you have a very strong witness or a very strong victim that is fairly secure in their identification of somebody, they're very helpful, because my experience has been they will pick out the person right away. The problem is most people are not that great of witnesses. Most people, for lack of a better term, pollute their recall of what's happened by their own biases, by people that have spoken to them after the crime has occurred. Let me give you a quick example. And it's very stereotypical, but it works out in a lot of cases. In my experience, women are much better witnesses than men. Women pay attention to detail of clothing, facial features,
physical structure features, whatever. So if I have a bank robbery, for instance, my best witnesses will probably be a woman. And again, this is very stereotypical and it's not in every case, but it's been my practice that that happens. On the other hand, if I have a crime where a vehicle is involved, men are much better witnesses. Men know cars, know the make of cars, know the little peculiarities they saw in the car, and tend to be better witnesses when it comes to that. Again, very stereotypical, doesn't happen all the time, but that's just been my experience. But people regularly pollute their recall of an incident because of the trauma they faced, the input they got from other people after the crime. That's one of the reasons cops separate people after a crime, so that they don't pollute each other's recall of what just occurred.
Do you want to talk about Runyon's escape from the penitentiary?
There are escapes frequently. I would venture, in my experience, the escapes are most frequent from residential facilities, minimum custody facilities. And some of the people that escape just is mind-boggling. Like somebody that's 2 months away from a release date, or somebody that's just getting ready to go for parole. But that's where you see the most escapes. You come into medium custody, jails, things like that. Very infrequent, doesn't happen very often, and especially now in the world of video, most of these facilities have everybody on video all the time. And then, of course, maximum security places doesn't happen very frequently, but they're high impact escapes because the people are usually pretty dangerous.
In like today's system, is there any privacy like in jails, or are there cameras like in every cell?
There are cameras in almost the entire facility. When Fort Madison was rebuilt, I heard one of the Iowa Department of Corrections people say that almost every inch of the facility is on some kind of video monitor.
Wow. When Runyon escaped and then was caught and put back in the penitentiary, the warden said something like, he'll be in there until I say he's out in solitary confinement. Are there rules around maximum amount of time people can be in solitary confinement?
Yes, there's both statutory law, depending on the state you're in, and then rules by the State Department of Corrections or whatever. That's really a controversial issue right now, because if you talk to people that work in facilities, detention officers, corrections officers, or solitary confinement, or isolation, it goes by a lot of different terms, segregation or segregated custody. That is a tool for those folks to use when people really misbehave in a facility. So in other words, they can hold that over people's heads. The other side of that coin has been, there's been a lot of studies that show that people devolve when they're in segregation, that the isolation, the, you know, everything stripped away from you, whatever, makes people with mental health issues more manic, more psychotic, and really doesn't help. So there's a huge debate going on in the jail and corrections world right now about how long you should keep somebody in some segregated position. So there's a lot of rules being written, a lot of state laws being written.
Do you have a stance personally?
I don't, because I see both sides of it. There are some people in facilities that are so dangerous, and especially, you know, with the elimination of the death penalty in most states, and, you know, even in states that it's still legally active, just isn't used very often. There are some people that just can't have around other people. They are going to victimize other people. So I see that part of it and where they should go. But I also see, if people get dumped into segregation just willy-nilly for whatever, that benefit is not that great.
On a brighter note, do jails still do things like magazines?
Yeah. There are people that come in and bring books in. You would be surprised to learn that some jails now are even handing out tablets to people as they come into the facility. They're very restricted on the tablets and what they can use, but they order their commissary, in other words, their stuff from the little canteen. They can do video chats, they can do emails back and forth, things like that. And it works out pretty good for the facility and the inmate.
Like, do they ever create like magazines or publications?
They do. They're called kites, little pieces of paper where they send messages to each other. And they use like, it would be like fishing string, but in the facility, it's probably a piece of cloth or something like that. And they push it between cells and then pull the pieces of paper back and forth between different cells.
But nothing, you put human, nothing organized by like, hey, we're doing like a penitentiary magazine and this person's going to be the editor of this. It's like an extracurricular is what Thomas Runyon was doing.
I think in the penitentiaries, in long-term lockups, you see that. In jails and short-term places, you don't.
Super interesting.
I had one other random question. Runyon was getting away. Well, one, had you heard of his book? It was called In for Life.
No, yeah, I have not. Okay.
I tried to find it and I don't think you can purchase it anymore. But then also he was getting away with stuff by disguising himself as a Catholic priest. Have you ever experienced that? I just feel like that's the perfect disguise.
No, I don't think I've ever run into that. I mean, I've run into people disguising themselves, but not that way.
Wait, what have your disguises looked like?
Mostly men dressing as women, like robbing a bank or something.
I feel like the priest move was kind of genius on his part.
All right. Any final thoughts on this one?
No, not really. Kind of interesting, just the circumstances that occurred.
All right. Thanks for joining. We'll talk to you next time.
Good evening.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.